You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Where the sidewalk ends and the road begins, we said goodbye on cold, dark nights. I'm not afraid to go.
Nine minutes after 8 on a Tuesday. Mike McNamara with you. Yesterday, in an interview that was intended to last about an hour, Jim Bathurst was on. And the interview stretches about 3 hours and 20 minutes. And because the gunner was sick yesterday, you heard parts 1 and 2 yesterday. You'll hear part 3 right now. It's an awesome interview about an improbable career. A high school dropout who's a communicator by trade, doesn't enjoy his time in the communication field and wants to be a grunt, becomes a grunt, gets sent to Vietnam in conjunction with getting the 0311 MOS as a sergeant. Learns on the job, weapons and tactics. His platoon commander is killed in Vietnam, and his platoon sergeant loses his shit. The company commander then names him the platoon commander, and he ultimately receives the Bronze Star and the Silver Star for actions as a platoon commander and a sergeant, and comes back as a staff sergeant, gets meritoriously, I think, promoted to gunnery sergeant while he's at 8th and I. He then receives word while he's still at 8th and I that he's going to be commissioned. He gets one of the coolest letters I think I've ever heard anybody receiving, telling him that you're the only commissioned officer in the United States of the Marine Corps without a high school degree. How about that for cool letters? And he gets his GED. He has people looking out for him because he can lead. The Marine Corps Mafia takes over and gets him to different places where he can get his GED and also get his 4-year degree and rises to the rank of colonel in the Marine Corps. So Jim Bathurst, interesting guy. He's now, he's going to come back on. He's involved in the Young Marines program, which is a mentorship program around the country. I would recommend it to you, but he's going to come back on and talk about that. Also written a book entitled We All Die as Marines. So if you go to the All Marine Radio website, and you roll on All Marine Radio, go to the podcast page, you'll see Bathurst prominently displayed there. Okay? Badass-looking picture of him with a cigarette in his mouth in Vietnam. And exactly. It's a cool-ass picture, too, trust me. Then another picture of him as a colonel. You can find both a link to buy his book called We All Die as Marines, and another one to his blog. Refers to himself as Sergeant B. So there's both parts 1 and part 2 on the website right now, but links to his and there's also a link to the Young Marine program, to their website. So part 3, Jim Bathurst, Marine, Sergeant B.
6.
Yeah. Do you go back to Vietnam as a captain?
No, I didn't. War was over now. This is now. It's now 72. We're pulling out.
Okay. So where does life take you? You got your GED. You're a captain, for God's sakes. You got a regular commission in the Marine Corps. Now what?
Well, I leave there and I go to. I had that rifle company for 27 months.
Wow.
My last battalion commander was another hero, John Hopkins.
Well, Big John, Big John Hopkins.
Big John. Big John Hopkins. What a guy. He taught me more. He taught me more about being a battalion commander than anybody. I love the guy. I literally love the guy. What a super guy. We had our times. There's an incident about him, where he and I got into a set to, and, I'm kind of a principled guy, and I stuck by my principles, and he could have very well fired me, for what I said I would do. It involved having dogs go through your barracks.
Oh, right.
You know, 70, 71, 72 were not good times in the Marine Corps.
No, tough.
The race problems we had and everything else, they were not really good times. They were horrible times.
Race and drugs,
and,
right?
Yeah.
Jim, let me ask you, of the two problems, race and drugs, which one was worse?
Race. Yeah. Race was bad.
People that serve now find that hard to believe. And I was talking to Carl Marlantis about race. And his, he obviously wrote the book Matterhorn, and he said, I experienced it in Vietnam. He said, and you'd be out in the bush, and it just disappeared because you're risking your life for each other. And then you came back to the rear, and you're there for however many days, you know, getting ready to go back out, and it appears. We segregated ourselves. And he said, and it was difficult. He said, but combat has a great way of equalizing everything.
I never experienced that in Vietnam in 66, 67. But boy, I'll tell you, up in San Mateo, the northern camp at Camp Pendleton,
right.
God almighty, we, I'll tell you how bad it was. The regimental CDO, the camp duty officer, had two reactionary platoons. He could call one. One was black, one was white. Depending on what the situation was.
It's hard for people to even entertain that. Barney Barnum was on, and we were talking about this, and he said, it was so bad. He said, I would go walk through the barracks on the weekend, and he said, I would have my dog, which was a German Shepherd, I think, and he said, I would have an axe handle in the other hand. And that's why I walked through the barracks.
Yeah.
Because you didn't know if you were gonna get jumped. I want to, before we keep talking about race, I just want you to comment if you wouldn't mind. Did you watch the Ken Burns series on Vietnam?
I got to the tent, and I stopped watching it.
Okay.
Give us
your thoughts.
I didn't like it at all. I'll say this about it. The very first couple episodes, I learned a lot.
Right.
I mean, I learned how far back Vietnam went in our political history. I didn't realize it went back that far, our involvement. Or our non-involvement, and our involvement, and our non-involvement. I mean, I learned a lot about it. So I was kind of glued to the TV for probably the first couple episodes. But then when they actually got into the shoot 'em up war, it really turned me off. I told the wife, I can't watch this anymore. He's putting a lot of personal opinion into this, and I don't agree with it. We went in there with a valid mission.
Right.
But it just got screwed up. I mean, screwed up bad. So I just couldn't watch it anymore. And I have read some reviews about it afterwards that I agreed with. That I thought it was a very slanted depiction of our involvement in Vietnam. I don't know. That's my opinion. Okay. So I didn't see the whole thing, no.
All right, let me ask you another question. One of the other things I've learned a lot about, I don't know shit about it. Do you know Ken Pipes? He was a company commander.
Yes.
Awesome guy. Everybody listening, Ken Pipes is was a company commander at Bravo Company 126 at Quezon, and lives out here in Southern California. And I'm working to get him on the program too. I just talked to him 2 nights ago, and he asked me one night we were talking. He said, "Max, do you know anything about Milai?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And then after I got off the phone, I said, "Well, that's not true. I know generalities about Milai, but I really don't know shit about Milai." So I start reading about it and then watching some videos, and I was initially blown away, and it got me interested because it was nothing like I thought. I thought they had been in country for a long time. I thought they had taken a lot of casualties and done a lot of fighting, and none of those were true. And so I kept reading. And so it's been very interesting to me in the process of discovery. You fought the BC as well. Was rape, was killing civilians, was that part of the Vietnam War that you experienced?
As far as U.S. forces,
yes,
doing those things, no. I saw none of that, none whatsoever. There were no free fire zones. There was no recon by fire. There was none of that. I mean, I wouldn't allow anything like that to ever happen. I mean, we the most successful program of any in Vietnam was the CAP program.
Right.
I have a good friend, retired lieutenant colonel, who got out of the Marine Corps, went and got a college degree and came back in the Marine Corps as an officer. He's now retired, but lives there at Lejeune. And he, as a sergeant in Vietnam, he got pulled to be a CAP squad leader. And when Tad and I would sit around and talk, and we had a CAP down along Highway 1 at the bridge south of our area. And anytime we ran any patrol down in that area, west of them was the Thang Quyet village, which comprised five hamlets. And it was about two clicks west of where they set up this CAP program. And of course, anytime we were running a patrol down there, it had to be coordinated with the CAP unit because they ran patrols. And I saw that particular village where this CAP program was part of the Thang Quyet complex, and it was Indian country.
Right.
I mean, anytime you went down there, you drew sniper fire. It was a given. And I used to draw the Thang Quyet more than anybody else. And I went to the company commander one time when I picked up my patrol round, and I said, "Sir, I'm going back to Thang Quyet." And he goes, "And?
your point, Bathurst?"
Yeah. And I said, "Does anybody else go to Thang Quyet? Why is it always me?" He goes, "No, it's not always you. You know, you just think it is. It's not." Well, that was bullshit. It was. And I hated going down into that area. I mean, you really had to be careful sticking your nose outside of a tree line. But when that CAP program went in down there, all of a sudden, that village right there where the CAP program was, and the next village west of them, it was unbelievable. I mean, the people would come out and welcome you, and the CAP program, by far, if we could have spread CAPs throughout Vietnam, I think we'd have had some success. I mean, Tad tells me stories about, he had one CAP program and they did so well and they wanted to start another one, a couple miles away and everything else. And he thought that he had trained his assistant squad leader to take over. So he asked his boss, can I move over there and take? So he moved over there and took over that calf that was just starting up. They did so much for the Vietnamese people. They won the hearts and minds of the people. And, that was the old saying that we were supposed to be there to do, to win the hearts and minds of the people. And the CAP program did that. It changed the whole philosophy of that area down there at that river junction, the river and Highway 1 junction. On the other side of the river south of us was 1-1's area. It was just a great program. But I saw none of that. I experienced none of that. With the drugs.
Right. Does that explain why so many Vietnam veterans hate John Kerry? The testimony that he provided in front of the Senate Foreign Relations, where he talked about those things were simply part of everyday Vietnam. And I would tell you, to a man, every guy, every infantry guy that I've asked about those questions has said the same thing. I'm not saying they didn't happen. What I am saying is Vietnam, you see that portrayed as a daily event. And
yes.
And sometimes civilians got killed. But we were the good guys. We were not the bad guys.
Yeah.
And
I kind of got the idea from that damn Vietnam series that he did that we were the bad guys.
Right. Interesting. No, and I love asking Vietnam guys those questions because, you guys have had to live with being painted like that forever. And as I watched the different videos I watched about My Lai, I sent the commandant an email, and I said, you know what, you need to teach about My Lai. You have this thing going, keep your honor clean. Sounds like a bullshit line to me. But watch the videos of the guys who were in My Lai with Charlie Company 120, I think they were. Watch what happened to their lives, how fucked up their lives got. I've seen interviews with them after, a couple years after when they're trying to explain it and I'd do it again and shit like that. And then 20 years later, they're a mess. You keep your honor clean. You want to know why you keep your honor clean? You keep it clean for you because you'll go to bed every night with that shit. And if you don't keep it clean, guess what? You won't have peaceful nights.
Yeah.
But I think if I was a Vietnam veteran, I would be pissed about that. Go ahead.
When we go to these reunions with Echo 2-1, the first couple ones I went to, I sat down with guys bawling, suffering from PTSD and everything, and try to comfort them. And Doc Weed, my corpsman, has spent his entire life traveling around the United States giving lectures on PTSD because he stayed in the medical field after he got out of the Navy. I kind of break it down into two parts. The Vietnam guys that stayed, and I'm talking strictly Marine Corps, that stayed in the Marine Corps, we hunkered down in our bases when we got back, and we were among fellow veterans.
Right.
And we could talk about it. The guys that got out of the Marine Corps after their tour in Vietnam had nobody to talk to. And they wanted somebody to talk to them, but nobody wanted to talk to them about it. And because of the label that had been put on them by guys like Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather and all of that crew, because of the label that had been attached to them, they had nobody to sit down and commiserate with and talk to them about it. You know, and that's the guys that really suffered from the PTSD. I mean, when I came home and went to my home, nobody wanted to talk to me. You know, nobody wanted to talk to me about Vietnam. Nobody asked me about Vietnam. And I didn't really want to talk to them because you had to have boots on the ground to talk.
Right.
And if your boots weren't there, then, you know, as I was writing this book, it took me 5.5 years to write this book. My editor is a very near and dear friend of mine, former Marine, retired as a major. He and I went on the bootstrap program together. We were both at Fort Bragg. He taught at SIOP school. I taught at Civil Affairs school. And we were both captains. He didn't have a college degree. I didn't have a college degree. But I had 2 years worth of college credits that I racked up in Fort Bragg. In fact, that's why I was sent to Fort Bragg. Another mentor looking out for me. When I was at AWS, the monitors come down and talk to all the captains about their assignment afterwards. Well, Ted Hopgood was our monitor, and Ted was one of the platoon commanders at Ceremonial Guard Company with me when I had SCP. So Ted says, when he comes to me, he goes, "Well, Jim," he said, "you've done it all, as a company grade officer. You've been to a barracks. You've been, FMF. You've done this. You've done that, done this." He said, "Where do you want to go?" And I said, where can I go?" He said, "You can go anywhere you want to. You've checked all the boxes for a company grade officer." So he throws a memo, tablet in front of me, with a list of places, and the top one was Marine Barracks, London, England.
Holy shit.
And I said,
"You know what, are you making some of this shit up, Bathurst? You just like, I'm going to get on Allman Radio, and I'm going to like tell him the biggest lies in the world."
No, honest to God, honest to God.
Holy
shit. He said, "Marine Barracks, London, England." I said, "Are you shitting me, Ted? I can go there." And he goes, "Yeah, because you've done all the things. You've had FMF, you've had overseas, you've been to a barracks, you've done this, you've been to AWS, you've checked all the boxes for a company grade officer. I don't have to assign you anywhere to check a box." He said, "So where do you want to go?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to go, that's an accompanied tour overseas with dependents." He goes, "Yeah." I said, "Shit, put me down for that." So he did. So, you know, I'm running around AWS telling all my ponchos there that I'm going to Marine Barracks, London, England. Well, you know, about 2 weeks before graduation, you know, you got a mailbox down in the basement where the cafeteria is, you know. And you go in there, and I open up my mailbox in the morning, and there's a note in there that says, "Call your monitor." So I call my monitor. And Ted answers the phone, and I said, "Sir, you know, Ted, this is Jim." No, he's a major by then.
Right.
I said, "Sir, this is Jim." What, you know, he goes, "Well," he said, "I got some good news and bad news for you." And I said, "Okay, what's the bad news?" He says, "You're not going to Marine Barracks, London." I said, "Well, shit, you told me I could go anywhere." He goes, "Yeah, but you need to go somewhere. And I know the perfect place to send you." He said, how many hours of college courses you've got?" I had 9. By then, I said, "I got 9 hours going to night school," and a night school here, night school there, night school there. So I picked up 3 courses, you know, and he goes, 9. He says, "Well, I'm going to send you to a place where there is a college campus on base that you can go to, and you can get at least 2 years of college credits while you're there for 3 years and be eligible for the bootstrap program." And I said, "Where's that?" He said, "Fort Bragg, North Carolina."
Wow.
I said, "That's a fucking Army base."
Yeah. Come on.
He goes, "Yeah, I know." He said, "But I'm going to assign you to the Army base because the instructor at Civil Affairs course at the Army was a temporary officer, and he just got reverted to gunnery sergeant. So I have to move him out, and I got to move him in there." And he said, "Jim, I'm telling you this right now." He said, That's the good news. Because I'm telling you, if you don't come away from Fort Bragg with enough credits to apply for the bootstrap program, you're never going to make major in this man's Marine Corps. So I bit the bullet. I went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I report into the colonel, the lieutenant colonel, that's the head. There's five Marines at Fort Bragg. And I go in and report to him, and he tells me I'm going to Civil Affairs School. So he takes me up and introduces me to this Army lieutenant colonel, infantry type. Bob Glasson was his name. So I'm standing there in uniform, and he looks at me, and I sit down, tells me to sit down. He opens up my book, and he's looking through me, and he goes, "Why aren't you wearing your jump wings?" I said, "Sir, I'm not jump qualified." "You're not." He said, "Well, this is a jump billet. You have to be jump qualified. So I'm going to have to send you to jump school. I'm 35 years old.
Nice.
I'm going to have to send you to jump school." I'm thinking, okay. And he says, "And you have no college." I said, "No, sir." He said, "You got 9 hours." I said, "I know." Well, as it turns out, again, small Marine Corps, the guy that I'm replacing had already gone. His name was Jim Keeley. He and I went through boot camp together. He had gotten a temporary commission. He never took any college courses or anything else. When it came time to revert all these guys, he got reverted back to gunnery sergeant. And as I found out later, much later during this tour, Bob Glasson looked at Jim Keeley as his son. He loved this guy. And it hurt him so bad that when Jim got reverted to gunnery sergeant, I mean, he was in tears when he found out that he was going to be reverted. So Glasson was upset because, first of all, I didn't have a college degree. There were five other majors in our office. They all had been on advanced degree programs, and this was the payback that they had to come and teach at the school. So I had five majors with master's degrees, and here's this dumb shit, GED, high school graduate captain coming in. So he said, "Go home for the day and come back and see me tomorrow morning." Well, I guess he went down and talked to the Marine and tried not to have me assigned to the school because I was unqualified. So when I reported in the next day, I report to the colonel. He said, "Sit down." He closed the door, and he said, "Let me give you," he said, "you know, I tried not to keep you, but I can't do that. I have to take you." He said, "So let me give you your priorities, Captain. Your number one priority here at Fort Bragg is a college education. Your number two priority are the 56 hours of instruction that you're going to be required to teach. Your third priority, if you have time, are the conduct correspondence courses. For every hour you teach at the school, there's a correspondence course for it also that you have to maintain." So I had 56 hours of correspondence courses that I was going to have to maintain. Oh. But he put the word "if" in there, if you have time. And I thought to myself, okay, you know, it's bullshit. Okay, I got it, you know. And he says, "And you got to go to jump school. I realize you're 35 years old and you're not a major, so you can't go through the gentleman's course. You're going to have to go through all 3 weeks." So anyway, I went to jump school. I come back. I'm now learning my classes as they're coming up on the schedule to teach. And it was Fayetteville State University. They have a campus on board the base. And he comes to me, this is now August, and it's getting time for the first semester to come up, or September, I guess. So he walks in, he reaches over top of me, I'm at my desk, and he lays down the base newspaper, and there's two pages of all the courses at Fayetteville State University are teaching up. He says, "Which one are you going to take?" I said, "Sir, I can't take a college night course." He said, I haven't taught all my classes. "Read my lips, Captain. Which course are you going to take?" So I picked out a course, I took it, I went to it, I got an A in it, I showed him my report card when I came back. The next 13-week semester started, he comes with me to the paper and he goes, "Which two courses are you going to take?" So I took two courses. The next semester, he comes to me and he shows me the paper. He says, you know, I've been looking at this paper. They actually teach courses during the day. So if you need one of these courses or teaching during the day, I want you to take 3 courses this time. I mean, I argued with him, but I was going nowhere. I said, sir, what? I can't teach. I can't teach a class during the day. What if I have a course during that day? He said, come with me. We go down to the operations, the scheduling office, to the major that's running the scheduling office, who was one of our majors in our course when I first got there. His name was Ray Blum. He goes, Ray, first of all, he said, which course do you need and can take? I said, well, here's one on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 1300 to 1430. So he goes down to Ray Blum and he says, Ray, you cannot schedule any of Jim's courses on Tuesday and Thursday from 1300 to 1500. Ray said, can I ask why? Colonel said, no. We walked out of his office. Colonel looked at me and said, see how easy that was? So every semester I took 3, and one time I took 4 courses. At the end of 2 years, I had 67 hours worth of college education. I applied for the bootstrap program, and I got it. And I went to Methodist University right outside the main gate of Fort Bragg. They sent me there for 16 months, and I wound up with a BA in economics. I mean, so in my book.
Economics? What are you, crazy? That's like a smart person's major. What about history or poli sci? The stuff dumb shit's take.
Yeah, see, I ask all my major academics, the guys there, I said, look, I need a piece of parchment paper. What's the easiest frickin' degree to get? And 2 of them typed up and said, sociology. So that's where I was going.
Right.
So I started taking all these, you know, I took all my basic courses. And then I started taking some sociology courses. And then when I went to college full time for 16 months, I started, you know, I took an advanced sociology course. And the professor was standing up there almost in tears telling us about all the problems in the United States, but he had no solutions for it. He was just identifying the problems. And I said, I can't do this anymore. So I changed my degree to business. And then I wound up, so the head of the business and economics department, Dr. Sudhakar Gautam from India, he and I hit it off real well, and all of a sudden I became his pet, and I decided to switch to economics. And my last semester there, I took 5 courses so I could get the degree in economics. But in my book, I clearly state that my ability to keep my commission in the Marine Corps was based on one guy, an Army Lieutenant Colonel. Because I know of no Marine Lieutenant Colonel in the entire United States Marine Corps that would have done what he did. That he made education my number one priority in that school. And honestly, I don't know, I myself as a Lieutenant Colonel, you know, in that position, I don't know whether I would have done that. I mean, Bob Glass,
let me just say,
as an officer in the Marine Corps.
You would have, I would have. And let me tell you why. Because a guy who walks in with that kind of proven record of leadership, you know, starting from, you know, the accelerated way you were promoted, the change in MOS, going to Vietnam, becoming a platoon commander, you know, your combat decorations, you earned every bit of that, son of a bitch. And I'll tell you what, and if there are other officers in the same situation that wouldn't have done it, shame on them. You know, you earn that. It's called combat credibility in the Marine Corps, right, Jim? I mean,
and
there's a reason why guys like Tony Zinni mention your name, okay? And I will tell you this, it's not because you're a shitbird either. Right? You don't get into that fraternity by being a shithead. Tell us about crossing paths with Zinni. How do you meet Zinni in the Marine Corps?
Well, like I said, I put him through OCS. I was his sergeant. I was his sergeant instructor.
Was he a good candidate? Was he a shit candidate?
Yeah, he was a good candidate. Yeah. Oh no, he was a good candidate. He was. He was a very good candidate. You know, like a damn bull. You know, and when I went to, I didn't finish telling you the story, when I went to the seminar, when I was a director of training at LLTC Lanton, I went up to the seminar at TBS, first time ever I ever walked in the hallowed halls of TBS, and so I went there, and one of their guest speakers is Zinni. I don't know what job he had at the time, but you know, I'm sitting there in the class, and I'm about in the middle of the classroom. And so he comes up, and he scans around the classroom, and all of a sudden his eyes lock on me, and he gets this, bows his head, and he kind of just shakes his head, and he said, I always enjoy coming down and talking to, speaking to seminars here at these Howard Halls at TBS. But he said, I just recognized somebody in this class. He said, so I'm going to have to be on my A game. He said, who's sitting in this class is my sergeant instructor from OCS. Stand up, Colonel. So I stood up, you know, and he goes, this guy's a lieutenant colonel in my Marine Corps today. And the last I saw of him, he was screaming in my face at OCS as a sergeant.
That is awesome.
Oh, Zinni.
That is awesome. You know what? I'll tell you what. I first crossed paths with him in 1989. He came to the basic school. He had just given up 9th Marine Regiment. General Van Riper was head of Marine Corps University, and he came out to the basic school to give his combat concept speech. And I'd never heard of Zinni. I was on my way out to AI a problem at the basic school, and I see Major John Kelly, who's in the news these days a little bit. And Kelly says, are you going to go see Colonel Zinni tonight? And I'm like, come on, sir, one more shitbang colonel that's going to give a speech at the basic school. Should I go? And he goes, you have to go see this guy. I said, all right. So I go that night. And I refer to Zinni as the burning bush, right, being a Catholic and all. I'd never seen a guy like that. Like, who the fuck is this guy? He's funny. Yeah. He's smart as shit. You know, his combat deployments, right? He's insulting Bill Lind in public, which we all loved, and he's giving it to General Van Riper in public, and we think that's hilarious because, you know, Van Riper was this maniac about discipline and uniformity, and we didn't understand it. I didn't understand it, and that's Van Riper's fault because he was teaching discipline, but he didn't have the communication skills that Zinni had. And so I go to that thing, and I see Zinni, and I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? You know? Incredible.
Yeah.
And so...
He took a lot of heat over the Cole thing, you know?
Right.
Because he was the one that arranged for the USS Cole to go into that port.
Right.
But he came out of it unscathed. And I think what he was doing was admirable. I understand why he arranged for the Cole to come in there. You know, I really felt bad for him when he was getting all the heat from the congressional people about why was the Cole even in there to start with and everything else. I don't know. He's a character. He is a character. Van Riper's the kind of guy I always say that he walks into a room and starts throwing sweat grenades around.
Listen to this. I'm teaching in a defensive section at the basic school. So we're transitioning from, I don't know, movement to contact or attacking something, and now the defensive guys are going to pick up this half of the company. And so the guy who's supposed to be with me, AI and this, half of the company, his wife goes into labor, and he says, Mac, we'll send somebody out there, but you're going to be there a while on your own. Okay, got it, not a problem. So they come in. Now they're starting to try to set in the defense, right? We're doing the accordion thing because the machine guns are trying to get set in, blah, 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 fucking blah. All of a sudden my radio cracks. Hey, Mac, just a heads up. Yeah, what's up? General Van Riper's on his way to your pause. I said, what? Exactly. What? And now I'm at the road's like on the left flank of this position. I'm at the right flank. And I'm like, screw it, man. He's going to see what he's going to see. So I keep keep talking and teaching and putting in machine guns. And I meet him about halfway. And he said, you must be Mac. I said, yes, sir. And he said, because the question that he said, how long have they been here? I said, less than an hour. He said, all right. He said, is this what I would expect from an average lieutenant company? I said, yes, sir. He said, all right. And then he just went and he started teaching. He said, are you here by yourself? I said, yes, sir. There's another AI, but his wife got sick or went into labor or whatever happened. And they're sending me somebody else out. He said, you need some help? And I said, yes, sir. He starts jumping down next to machine guns, talk about PDFs and FPLs. And lieutenants are looking, going, what the hell? But, yeah, he could make your ass sweat. In fact, Zinni, in this presentation he did at the basic school, I mean, he's so funny. At one point, he talks about a PME that he did at 9th Marines. He said, and I had Colonel Van Riper, is it Colonel Fike?
Yeah.
And Colonel Ripley, all there. He said, and now Van Riper's sitting there, and Ripley was sitting there, and he looks over and he says, they called one the Prussian, who I won't name, one the philosopher, and one the surfer. And then he looks over at Van Riper and he says, don't wax your board, General. Right? And the whole place loses it. And he's just such an expert at setting the hook in everybody, because what he was selling was maneuver warfare, being a thinker, being a reader, studying your craft, all of that, that I don't know we did that much of. And he was setting the hook by using his sense of humor, his smarts, and all that stuff that he does. And I was just blown away. I said, I want to be like that guy someday when I grow up. And so,
he's quite a guy. Well, that's the last time I saw him. I haven't seen him since. I've gotten some YouTube videos of him giving speeches. He goes out to the Marine Memorial Hotel out in San Francisco a lot. And gives talks out there.
Is General Myatt still running that?
Yes. Well, as far as I know, he is.
Right.
Yeah, as far as I know, he is.
The
very well.
We've got about I've got 10 minutes left that I want you for, because I've taken up too much of your time. And but I hope you don't mind. In the future, we need to do this again about different issues. All right. Talk to us about becoming an author. Where does that come from? For God's sake, you're using crayons most of your life, and now all of a sudden you're writing books. Where does that come from? What made you write?
Well, you know, when I retired from the Corps, I was bitter. I was fed up. I was burned out. I was just short of 36 years, and I was really burned out. I hated my boss. So when I left the Corps, I made a snap decision. He and I got into a tiff one time in his office, and I got up and stormed out of his office. I went home that night. I lived on base. My wife was working at the bank in Jacksonville, and when she came home, and we had talked about what we were going to do when we retired. We had a little fifth wheel, a little 30-foot fifth wheel camper, and the thing was, we were going to put our stuff in storage for a year, and we were going to travel around the Marine Corps, around the country, and go where we wanted to go instead of where the Marine Corps wanted us to go. And when we talked about it often, almost every night. He and I got into this tip. I went home that night, and she got home from work, and I said, pack your bags. I'm retiring. I went into work the next morning, told the adjutant to type up the message. I signed it, and it went out, and I left. In October of 1993, and we toured the United States in our little camper for a year, and had the time of my life. And I really needed that. I was no longer Colonel Jim Bathurst; I was just Jim Bathurst. We wound up coming into Montana, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. We bought a small cattle ranch, and I played cowboy for 10 years. And
hold on, what city in Montana?
Roscoe.
For those of you that have never been to Montana, it's one of the most beautiful states, and it's a gigantic state. One of the most beautiful states in the country.
From Red Lodge.
Absolutely fantastic people there, yes?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
And so we used to, I owned a little house in front of me that I rented out to a retired Army major, and he would take care of my cattle. I had six cows. He'd take care of my cattle during the winter, and Nancy and I would go down to Phoenix, Arizona in our camper, and we'd spend January, February, March down there, and I'd knock off his rent. And he would feed my cattle, you know, twice a day and what have you. And while I was down there, I used to sit out on the picnic table with a scotch and a cheap cigar, and I started typing things about my career. And I'd fill up a Word doc, and then I'd go to the next one. And it was things that my kids would read after I was dead and gone to find out why, to know why, the real truth about why I missed their first baseball game, their first dance recital, birthdays, and things like that. And I'd fill up a doc, several pages, and then I'd go into another one, and I had several of these. Well, Denny and I, who became my editor, he and I were talking on the phone one day, and I was telling him about this. Now, this is now after I left Montana. So this is now 1994. And he said, why don't you send me a couple of those? Well, for what? And I told him, they're for my kids to read, nobody else. So anyway, long story short, I sent him a couple of these. He comes back to me and he says, you know, you've got the makings of a hell of a good book here. If you just kind of put them in chronological order and follow your career, in these things, I told stories about some of these guys like John Dunn, you know, my singer drone instructor, and Gunny Brinkman and Gunny Cobb and Gunny LaPlace and all those people, so anyway, to make a long story short, about 2007, I guess, we really started getting serious about this. And he said, why don't we make this into a book? Now, Denny is a writer.
Right.
He's an English major, and he's a writer, a very good writer. I'm not. Even to this day, I'm not. So anyway, we started on it, and I decided to take all the personal stuff out of the book. There's nothing in there about my personal life. I'm on my third marriage. So there's nothing in there at all about at the end of the book, I basically say that tell the reader that while you read all these trials and tribulations and all the things that I've done and all the people that I've met, the funny stories and the tragic stories about them, understand that while all of this is going on, there was some personal turmoil in my personal life that I don't care to talk about. So I explain that at the end of the book. So anyway, we started on this, and it took us 5.5 years.
Wow.
Started on in 06, and the book was published in December 2012. My wife is the one that came up with the name of it. My wife is also a good writer. She's the one that came up with the name, We'll All Die as Marines, from a story in the book that she was proofreading for me. And we worked on it. You know, I wasn't going to talk about Vietnam, so we argued about that. He made me put some stuff in there about Vietnam. I was going to skip Vietnam, because I didn't want to talk about the war. I didn't want to make it a war book. And then when I sent him the last chapter of Vietnam, the next chapter started off with me reporting into Marine Barracks 8th and I. He calls me right away and says, you're not going to talk about how we were treated when we got back from Vietnam? And I said, no. He said, but Jim, you have to. You have to explain that to the reader, what we went through when we came back to Vietnam. And we argued about it, and I flat out said no. A couple nights later, I went out with Nancy and I went out to dinner with these liberal friends that we had living next door in Girard, Illinois. And somehow or another, the discussion got into Vietnam from her. She was the inquisitive one. And I tried to steer the conversation away from it because neither one of them served, and I knew they were liberals, and I didn't want to get into an argument at the damn dinner table.
Right.
And but she just kept prodding and prodding and prodding, and I mentioned something. So finally, I got mad, and I said, there was no silent majority back then. If there was a silent majority, and that's what the silent majority is, I don't want to be one of them. And she argued with me. She said, well, we supported the Vietnam, and a lot of America supported the Vietnam, and, you know, the Vietnam veterans, da 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 da. She just went on and on. I knew somebody that came back to Vietnam, and I used to tell you, and she just went on and on and on and on and on. Finally, we ended the dinner, and we left. And I didn't say a word at all going back. I went home that night, about 10 o'clock, went into my office, and at 4 o'clock the next morning, I sent Denny a chapter called The Silent Majority. And that's how that came into the book. And he is such a good, I mean, we both bought the Chicago Manual style, which has got to be the worst reference book that was ever invented, but that's what publishers use as the Bible.
Right.
You know, I mean, I learned about EM dashes and EN dashes and I mean, I got a degree in history just working with the Chicago Manual, or not history, but English, working with so we published a book. I went to a POD, publisher, I'm not making a lot of money out of it. I'm still getting requests for the book. I sell more books than what iUniverse does. The book, as far as I'm concerned, is a success. I've linked up with so many Marines of my past who, Google Jim Bathurst, in Google, and all of a sudden the book pops up. And I get an email wanting me to send them a book. I sell the book for $30. I had nothing to do with the pricing of the book. It's based strictly on the pages, and they priced the book at $42.95, which I think is extravagant.
Yeah, wow.
But I got the money back that I paid to have the book printed. So now I sell the book to Marines for $30, and I eat the postage. And I don't get the same discount that Barnes & Noble or Amazon get. So it actually cost me 63 cents to sell a book. I make nothing off of selling the book at all.
All right, so Jim, that's the first book. You've written the second book, A Kernel of Truth.
Well,
is that a blog or a book or what?
No, it's a blog that I wrote.
Okay. Tell us about that.
I have been prodded to write a second book, and if the young Marines weren't keeping me so damn busy as they are right now, I probably would do it. I have a name for the book, and I know what the book would be about. It would be a compilation of short stories about sergeants and corporals. And the name of the book would be Only a Sergeant, which is a chapter in my book. And it deals with how I got my Silver Star and everything else. And I basically say that it was probably put in as a Navy com, but it was, that's how I end the chapter. It was probably put in as a Navy com, but it was upgraded to a Silver Star because I was only a sergeant. And that's what the book would be about. I don't know if that'll ever come to fruition or not, but I would like to do it, and it would kind of be a primer for the young corporals and sergeants today to read and learn, what it means to be a sergeant. I mean, throughout my career as a lieutenant colonel, as a colonel, I would have young lieutenants, come up to me and ask me, sir, you've been a private to gunnery sergeant, second lieutenant to colonel. What's the greatest rank you ever held? And without any hesitation, I say, Sergeant. And they would look at me and say, Sergeant? And I said, yes. And why Sergeant? And I said, because that's where the rubber meets the road. By the time you get up to Colonel, it ain't fun anymore. There's nothing fun in the Marine Corps about being a Colonel. You know, you're so far removed from the troops that it's, that you have to really work at getting out and talking to troops. And when you do, you excite all the junior commanders under you. Why is the colonel talking to my troops?
Right, right. And then, you know, it's really interesting. When I was in, Ramadi in 2004, I'd been in the reserve for 10 years. And I never went to a drill in my life. So, the march up is executed. The first division comes back. I have friends who emailed me and said, hey, come on active duty, we're going to Iraq. And I said, we're not doing that shit. And they said, oh yeah, we are. But I was like out the fuck out. I wasn't in the reserves, anything. So I had to get reappointed. So long story short, I get reappointed, but it's after the march up. So I send an email, to a couple of my friends, both are major generals now, Paul Kennedy and Dave Furness. And I said, hey, just so you know, I just got reappointed. And they're like, don't touch anything. We just got told we're going back. And you'll go with us. So I deployed with a division to Ramadi in 2004. General Mattis's, the CG, his aide gets wounded. They make the staff sec, the aide, and Kelly comes to me. I was working in plans, and he says, hey, I've got another job for you. I said, what's that? And he says, the division staff sec. I said, what's that? And it sounds kind of gay. And he says, well, it is kind of gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that. He said, but it's a better job than this one, and I needed an adult. I worked for Kelly at IOC and met him at the basic school. So I go to work for General Mattis, General Kelly, and with Colonel Dunford. And, you know, the hardest thing they did was to try to get the truth and be able to talk to Marines, just to emphasize your point.
Yeah.
And not only just to talk to them, but then to dial down the tension that everybody gets in, that gets induced, like, oh, the general's coming. Okay, here's what's going on.
Yeah.
Look, I just want to talk to them. I want to find out what they need. How do I help? And I remember Colonel Dunford saying, Mac, I can control a couple things. I can give you more equipment. I can give you more personnel. I can't do anything. I can put more emphasis on something. I can't do anything if I don't know about it and if you tell me at the last second. That's my job here. That's what I do.
Yeah.
And the hardest thing for them, though, was to just get to Marines. But you can still see it in Mattis's face. The happiest he ever is when he's with junior Marines.
Oh, yeah. 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 Yeah.
But.
No. You know, I never served with Mattis. He was after me. I mean, he was in when I was in, but you know, I didn't know of him or anything else. But I know John Kelly.
Right.
When I first got from the War College down to Lejeune. I'm trying to think of who the hell was his name, was a CG then. Darn it. I'll think of it in a minute. But anyway, his philosophy was that no lieutenant colonel comes to his division anointed to a battalion.
Oh.
So you serve your pendants in the division, Murphy, Dennis Murphy is his name.
On the division staff, right?
Yeah, you serve your time in division staff and then you get a battalion. So the only billet open for a lieutenant colonel was the assistant division inspector. So that's what I got assigned to. Well, one of my jobs was McCress,
right,
for the infantry battalions. And a good friend of mine, who made general, he and I were on the drill field together. We went to AWFs together with Wayne Rawlings. And it was Wayne's battalion. So I had a major assigned to me from the G3 shop that was going to be my assistant umpire for this exercise. So because I knew Wayne, I told this major, I said, look, normally the senior umpire shadows the battalion commander. I said, the battalion commander is a personal friend of mine. So I'm going to opt out of this, and I'm going to have you shadow Lieutenant Colonel Rollins. I said, I will spend my time in the COC with the S3. Well, the S3 with John Kelly. He was the captain.
Right.
So anyway, I rode in his Amtrak. I slept near him, on the ground and everything else for the 72 hours for the crash. And let me tell you, I threw everything at them with the damn kitchen sink, because I would throw a trap, tactical recovery of a downed aircraft.
Aircraft and personnel.
And then they'd be working up the plan, and just as they were getting ready to exercise it, I'd throw another one at them. Evacuation of some civilians. And I just kept throwing things. And this guy was just as calm and cool, as collected and everything, and of course Wayne is a Navy Cross recipient. I mean, he's a hell of a Marine. So they did very well on the McCrest. It was the best McCrest I ever had. I only had that job for 6 months. But I think I did two of them, but anyway, Wayne and I are at the club on that Friday night. It ended Friday morning. We gave the brief that afternoon. So I'm in the club Friday afternoon and Wayne comes in. So we saddle up to the bar together and we're shooting shit. I said, I've got one question for you, Wayne. He said, what's that? I said, where in the fuck did you find that 3? He says, you talking about Kelly? I said, yeah. He said, ain't he something? I said, he is. He said, that boy's going to be a 4-star someday. He sure is.
For those of you who don't know Wayne Rollins, he's a bit of a legend in the Marine Corps as well. These are big men in the Marine Corps. Jim, first of all, I want to thank you for doing this. I've been looking forward to it for a long time.
You're welcome.
And I did not know all the layers of your story. But I'm glad you came on and talked about it. And also the other thing is I'm glad we could do this and get this out of the way, because I want to bring you back on and talk purely about leadership. And I want to talk specifically for corporals and sergeants. I have one of my sons is a platoon commander in Kilo Company 3-5, another's teaching at the basic school. And so my life's still about the Marine Corps, and this will be, we're closing in on 2,000 episodes here on All Marine Radio.
Want to
create more stuff for junior leaders that tells them how to be better. And I think we've gotten away from some of the discipline, in my opinion. Some of the stuff where, your sergeants, even if they lived off base, they showed up, half hour, 45 minutes before formation, they're hanging out in the barracks. They're standing out on the walkway, inspecting uniforms of their Marines as they go to formation, stick their head in before you shut the door to make sure everything's good. And that's just how the day starts.
I don't think we do
those kind of things anymore. And the reason that, I was in Iraq twice in Afghanistan, and you'll go to war as you are in garrison. There isn't some fairy dust that happens on the way over that locks your
shit on for
quote unquote combat. And so if you're squared away, if you can execute in garrison in terms of carrying out the plan of the day, inspections, and as you said, expect what you inspect. And if you learn that, you'll go there and fewer people get killed as you learn. And it's just, it's sad when you see ragged, undisciplined units, because if you ever go in harm's way, you'll get your head kicked in.
Which is
unnecessary because you're just undisciplined. So I want to talk to you about that because you're
I would love to do that. I mean, I got lots of sergeant stories because when I was thinking about writing this book, I went out to everybody and I got a folder in my email program called Marines, of course.
Right.
And I don't know how many addresses are in there. So I just sent an email out to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm thinking about writing a book about sergeants, and corporals. If you got some corporal stories, that's fine. But it's going to be called Only a Sergeant. And I already got the cover designed and everything else, and I said, so what I like is I would like some sergeant stories from you. about sergeants that you knew or you were the one about leadership. And, you know, even some bad stories about leadership. No names,
right.
You know, and what have you. Well, I was surprised. You know, I didn't get a damn one from my peers. Colonels and lieutenant colonels. You know, and they emailed me back and say, Jim, I don't really know any sergeant stories. And I think to myself, are you shitting me?
Yeah, how can you not know a sergeant story?
Yeah, you never saw a sergeant do some extraordinary thing? You got to be kidding me. Where the hell were you? You know, I mean, I got tons of them. But I don't want to write the book. I want other people to write the book. I want them. So I did get some in. I probably got about 20, 25 of them. But they were all from staff NCOs and junior officers. The senior officers didn't send me shit, nothing. And I just find it hard to believe. I guess they stayed in their office all the time. They never went out and observed and, you know, leading by wandering around. So I'd love to do that. I'd love to do that, Mac.
You know, and I have a book that I want to write. And it's based on simply, when my oldest was, probably second lieutenant 1-7, they deployed to Iraq. Right when we were going back in, and they mostly did security at the Qatim, there. And, but you know, I thought about my son going, and I thought, well, you know, what would I tell my son if he's going to war? You know, what would I want him to know? And so it kind of popped into my head about a book like that. Things I'd like my son to know before he goes to war. And it's been really interesting because I'll ask guests on the program, and if you could give only one lesson about going to war to your son or my son, what lesson would that be? And you know how sacred that guys who've been to war take that kind of stuff. And the answers I've got to from it are incredible. Are incredible, and they're certainly worthy of a book. And the best part about it is that it's not like we're going to write about the attack, and then we're going to write about counterattacks and the defense and, you know, tactics. There's only so much. There's a million answers for that question based on
Absolutely.
Your experience. And it's all designed to be focused at the junior leader in the Marine Corps. And so I'm going to have you back, and we'll talk about leadership.
Okay, I'd love to do it, Mac. I'd love to.
And then the other thing I want to talk about when you come back is the Young Marines program. And you make everybody smart about that, because there's a lot of guys, you know, you grow up living a purpose-driven life, and all of a sudden you're not doing that anymore. You're retired, or you're working for money or something like that. And a lot of people struggle with that. Working for money, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, how do I do? Yeah. I need something else in my life. Whether it's, you know, with the Marine Corps League or volunteering at the VA, I need something that makes my life make sense to me. And young Marines, as you say, you get involved in those kind of programs, and it takes over your life because they're so intoxicating. Yeah. And I would tell you this, you alluded to it, young people need more discipline and more structure now because they don't get it anyplace else.
No. No, don't get it at home, don't get it at school, they don't get it anywhere.
Right.
Whatever
you want to give, and if you want to slime out of it or if you want to quit, yeah, that's okay. And the question they get asked most often, how did that make you feel? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Shit, do you remember ever as a kid being asked, how does that make you feel?
No. No. No.
You made me laugh when you told the story about your dad and you working on the muskrat. And you said, what are you doing? And he said, shut up. Right? And what did you do? You shut up, right?
Yeah, I shut up, yeah. And, right. and he said, and don't you dare tell your mother about it.
The best part is your mom ate muskrat and didn't even know it. That is awful. You'll spend a little bit of time in purgatory for that. All right, sir, first of all, thank you very much for being a guest here on All Marine Radio. And I look forward to doing these things in smaller segments and not taking up so much of your time. But, Jim...
I enjoyed it, Mac. I really enjoyed it. You caused me to reminisce about things that are, some things that I hadn't thought about, well, since I wrote the book. I mean, you know, I want to send you a copy of the book. Send me your home address via email, and I want to fire off the book to you.
Will you sign it?
Yeah. Oh, of course. Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. The man that had the golden halo over his head throughout his long, distinguished career. Thank you very much again, Jim, for doing this.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Quite welcome, Mac.
How about that? Unbelievable. Unbelievable career, and all based on his ability to lead. High school education, if you can lead, people will find a way to open doors for you. I'm convinced of it. The Marine Corps is not that different in terms of the mafia that can lead tends to take care of other younger, both enlisted Marines and officers that they see that they can lead. So you'll hear more of Jim Bathurst in the future, but my privilege to have him on. We'll take a break. When we come back, the gunner's going to join us. Yeah, how about that? So don't touch that dial. Looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Matt.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.